Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. What happens when race is not inherited at birth, but acquired, even chosen later in life? What happens when you get race after you arrive as an immigrant to the United States? Those are questions asked by author Sharmila Sen in the beginning of her new memoir, Not Quite, Not White, Losing and Finding Race in America. She's also the executive editor-at-large at Harvard University Press, and she joins us now. Sharmila Sen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Maria.
Of course. So you grew up in Calcutta, India, where, as you explain in the book, race isn't one of the methods of social segmentation. In fact, it wasn't really part of the cultural dialogue the way it is in America. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about the lines which you did see your community divided by.
Of course. I grew up in India till I was 12 years old. And of course, while we didn't have race, we had lots and lots of different ways of dividing ourselves up. I think all societies do. Mm-hmm. For us at that time, of course, it was we divided up ourselves according to lines drawn around language, religion, ethnic group, caste, economic class, and even geographic region, such as North versus South India. And just as lots of societies around the world, which have devised ways of creating these lines of partitions for creating hierarchy or creating social divisions, there were also as many ways of traversing those lines, mm-hmm. right, of crossing those boundaries, mm-hmm. and then also being alert to checking who's crossing those boundaries. We had all of those ways of dividing ourselves up, but race we didn't have.
So I want to get to a passage in your book and have you read it. It's at the very beginning of your memoir. You write about a conversation you had with a friend from your English PhD program where you ask why everyone always sort of gravitates toward the two of you at parties, and you're sort of contemplating this, and he tells you it's because you, an Indian woman, and him, a black man, smile so much more than the rest of the people around you. You ask him why you smile so much. Will you take it from there and
sure.
read the passage?
And absolutely. And if people could see us right now, actually, you and I are smiling
yeah.
at each other a
yeah.
lot. And
we
have these big grins. On
yeah.
our, and
yeah.
and so this is the section where I talk about the smile.
Right.
Why do we smile so much? I ask him. My cheeks hurt from smiling so much, and I cannot keep it up. We smile, he tells me, because it is the only face we can show. If we stop smiling, they will see how angry we are, and no one likes an angry black man. Or an angry brown woman, I add silently, editing our conversation. But I think you know this already, he continues, and so you smile wide and crack all those jokes. At the end of the 19th century, the African-American poet Paul Laurence Dunbar wrote, "We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes." In the early decades of the 21st century, I know that if I stop grinning, I will frighten others with my anger. Anger is the useless emotion of people with grievances. Civilized people, superior people, capable people manage anger through reason, televised town hall meetings, logic gates, strategic planning, branding exercises, op-eds, and fireside chats with tea and sherry.
That resonates so much. I think as a country, we're having a conversation right now, a reckoning with anger, right? You hear writers like Rebecca Traister imploring Americans to listen to why people are angry, to confront anger, and to stop avoiding it. What did you wrestle with when you were writing this book and thinking about anger in a way?
I think one of the things I wrestled with was the idea that, you know, I think in many ways, and I write about this in the book, that anger has become something of a third world emotion, or that it's not a heroic emotion anymore. Right. You know, so I go all the way back to...
But there's something crass to, in
there's
anger,
something
right?
crass. You know, it's not heroic in the kind of epic sense
right.
that the anger of Achilles, you know, there was a time when anger of heroes and gods is what kind of gave rise to great narrative. But there's just, you know, this is why I said, you know, anger is the stuff, is the emotion of the losers or people with grievances. And by which I really mean is actually that we have words, you know, if heroic anger is gone, that we have other words for angry brown people or angry black people or angry women, you know, that, that there are some people who can't, I think, be allowed, particularly in contemporary American society, to express their anger. Or if when they do, that the price they pay for it is much greater than the price perhaps a white man might pay for his anger.
Perhaps somebody like President Trump, who sometimes appears angry, or Brett Kavanaugh at his Supreme Court hearings when he was waiting to be confirmed, showed a lot of anger when the Senate tried to question him about the allegations
yes,
of rape.
Yes, yes. I mean, in fact, in both those examples, you see that...
Of assault,
you know,
I should say.
It's a kind of anger that, you know, in the second case, there's, you know, of the Kavanaugh case, it's been, I guess, I've read about this in the media, that that was also a kind of a stage-managed anger, that maybe, you know, that there was some advice that, you know, to perform that way would help him achieve his goals. And that kind of anger has worked, and I would just say in contrast to that, so if we're looking at our present president's performance of anger... Mm-hmm. Very public performance of anger, and the way it resonates, I think, even positively with some people. If we look at the previous president, who was possibly,
right.
you know, the most controlled, the least angry, you know,
right.
and even the cadence of his speech,
right.
the measured tones, you know,
there's a professorial quality almost.
Yes,
about
and
it,
I
yeah.
think we, I mean, you know, we ascribe these things to their personalities, but I think that, you know, while that may be the case, it just might be that one is more measured and professorial in their speaking tone, and the other is more kind of, you know. Loud and angry, but I think it's also because they're also historical products of
right.
a particular society. So they're also, you know, doing things that society allows them to do, or doing things that they know is sort of almost encouraged by the society of which they're a product. So I look at each of them as both individuals, but I think also as kind of products of large historical moments.
Right, as we all are, right?
Right.
So when you moved to America, actually to Cambridge, you could really see the cultural divisions in the U.S. with much greater clarity. What do you remember about those very first impressions?
I think the very first impressions I remember, I when I came to Cambridge first, I started in seventh grade at the Peabody School, which was then located on Linnean Street, and which is in a fairly well-off part of Cambridge. It still is. That's a nice neighborhood. That's not where our apartment was, so I used to walk or take the school bus over there. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I had arrived in August, and the school department assigned me to the Peabody School. I started, this is 1982. Boston had just undergone its immense desegregation program. Busing was a word that was kind of whispered around by the teachers. As a kid, I didn't quite know what it meant. But what I did know was where kids sat in the cafeteria, you know, and I was completely new to this country, new in a way I don't think immigrants today can be new anymore, because you have to remember this is pre-internet, pre-social media. Mm-hmm. I'd never left my country, India, until I was 12 years old. So I was really seeing America through brand new eyes. And what I was watching was where do the kids sit? And I was picking up a lot about race, about socioeconomic status, about, and to a lesser extent, a little bit about religion, too.
Now, you lay out so many ways that you try to achieve, quote, total Americanization, capital T, capital A. You even constructed what you call a field guide for going native.
First, will you explain what that means and then tell me what it looked like? How did you go native?
Yes. Well, total Americanization, because I think that, you know, when you're 12 and you come as a foreign kid to the public schools of America, you want to blend in really fast. It's not a pleasant thing to be the foreigner in an American public school playground. And I just threw myself into it, you know, between start of fall 1982 and Christmas. You know, I was always an overachiever, so I think this is how I thought I would do it. So I could learn, first of all, to speak this way, the way you hear me speak right now. Right. This is not how I spoke back then.
Yeah.
And so part of it was, of course, the usual stuff of any 12-year-old girl. You know, you try to figure out what the latest clothes are and how are kids supposed to dress. It was the 80s, you know, so I cut off all the waistbands and neckbands off my sweatshirts, wore them inside out. I learned to try and, you know, sort of what the popular music is. I watched a lot of television. So I came home by 3 o'clock. I was alone in our apartment. My parents were at work. And we had this tiny black and white hand-me-down TV. And I watched General Hospital and then every single rerun I could find. And I was basically trying to get an American accent. That was my first step into total Americanization, is to speak American.
Well, you know, we're running out of time here, but for our last question here, I want to ask you, eventually you did reach that place where you were, as you say, passing as white. But then at some point when others affirmed that for you, saying, I don't see you as white, you were really angry. So tell me about that transformation from wanting to pass to being angry when people met you there. How and why did that anger set in? We've come full circle with
anger.
Yes,
absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, the very thing I wanted, which is to pass, to blend in, and other than my name, a lot of people on the street wouldn't know I wasn't white. But just when I thought I achieved it, you know, I mean, if not actually being seen as white, but something like a white adjacent or an honorary white, right? When that happened, I felt incredibly angry because I felt like I had given up some part of myself or others had forgotten it. I had become that kind of comfortable token minority, the sort that provided sort of diversity without a lot of discomfort. And that didn't feel right. You know, I wanted to just sort of put my face in the pillow and scream as I achieved the very thing I thought I had wanted when I was 12 years old.
Yeah. Well, Sharmila Sen, thank you for joining us. She's the author of Not Quite, Not White, Losing and Finding Race in America.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Maria Garcia. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.